Come on, Jason.
And welcome to a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, and we've got a fantastic show on the agenda today. We're going to continue our Major League Baseball wraparound series here, and today we're going to be talking about the Washington Nationals. The National League, we did the American League East, and now we're going to move on and start talking about the National League East as well. It seemed like it made a lot of sense, and so that's where we're going to progress from here. Lots to talk about here. We're going to have Andrew Simon from MLB.com on today with us. Really fantastic writer over there. Hopefully, if you're not tuning into him already, that after today you will be, because he does great work over there. So we'll be talking with him today about what's going on with the Nationals. And as you know, the format for the program is that we try to review 2015, what we expected from a club going into 2015. We look a little bit at what happened in 2015, and that really is what makes the Nationals so interesting, is that they might have been the most disappointing team in baseball last season. So to be able to look at what they did, what happened, what went wrong is interesting. Then, of course, we look at their offseason. If they did a lot of bad things in 2015, what are the changes, what additions or subtractions happened in the offseason? And then, of course, we'll preview 2016, and I'll put Andrew on the spot and expect him to put together some kind of prediction about what he expects from the Washington Nationals. So Andrew Simon from MLB.com, he's a Washington, D.C.-based writer for MLB.com. He's also, you can find his work over at spotsonearth.com. And, of course, you can follow him on Twitter at Andrew Simon MLB. So that's his resume for a little bit if you want to know a little bit about him. And now we're going to talk with him for about a half an hour to 45 minutes. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, it's at CJMitch73. If you'd like to follow the program on Facebook or just talk baseball with us, we'd love to have you. You can do that in our Facebook group. It's a podcast to be named later. I write for a variety of different websites. If you want, just head on over to Twitter, and you can find out where those are. And I'm sure I'll remind you later on in the program, but I'm not going to waste your time right now. But today, the Washington Nationals with Andrew Simon. Let me bring him into the program. Andrew, thanks a lot for coming on today. How's everything going on with you? You being down there in Washington, D.C., you got pelted. My brother lives down in that neck of the woods. You guys got pelted a couple of weeks. Does that put you in the mood for baseball more or less? It actually, I always say it makes me excited to be talking baseball, but I can see how maybe that makes me a little bit crazy.
No, I think everyone around here is looking forward to spring, and I'm definitely looking forward to spring training, hopefully getting down to Florida and seeing some sun.
Yeah, you Virginia people with snow are sort of like California people with rain. It just doesn't seem like you can drive with it. It just doesn't seem like you're prepared for it. Everybody down there knew that you were going to get 3 days worth of snow, and yet you, my brother's daughters missed 6 days of school. It's like 6 days for a storm up here in Boston. We missed like 6 hours. I was like, you guys need to get things together. I don't know with you guys and snow.
Yeah, well, I'm from California, and I live here now, so I know all about both of those things. But the infrastructure here is just not set up very well for big snowstorm.
No, definitely not. And you've had a couple over the last few years, and I actually lived in California for a very short time, so I know what the 405 is like, and I know how rain just throws a monkey wrench into everything, but not exactly important when it comes to the baseball world. But the Nationals had an interesting 2015. Let's get right into your sweet spot here a little bit. Before we actually look at what they did last season and this season, I do want to ask you a couple of basic questions, which is Mike Rizzo as the GM. This Nationals team is very interesting. I think they're schizophrenic. There are lots of possible ways you could analyze this team, disappointing or injuries. Or there's lots of ways, and we'll get into those. But that's what makes analyzing Mike Rizzo and whether he's done a good job or a bad job, I think, makes it very interesting. In your opinion, what do you think? How good has he done? How bad has he done? What's your analysis on him as a GM? And is he safe? If the Nationals disappoint again, could we be talking or hearing about a possible change there?
If they disappoint again, I mean, I could see that maybe becoming an issue. But I do think that the thing people have to remember when talking about Mike Rizzo is you have to, you know, keep what's happened in the context of where things started for the Washington Nationals. You know, they came from Montreal in 2005, and this is a team that really didn't win for its first several years. And when Mike Rizzo took over for Jim Bowden, I mean, things were really in kind of in disarray, and he's really taken it from that to a team that is expected to, you know, win, make the playoffs every year. So I think you have to give him a lot of credit for that. Last season in 2013, things did not work out. In 2012 and 2014, they did. You can certainly criticize some of the moves that he's made, but I think when you view things in a little bit of a wider lens, you have to appreciate where he's helped the franchise go.
Yeah, for me, it's difficult because I follow prospects. I write about prospects over at rotoexperts.com, as well as a little bit for Baseball America, as well as minorleagueball.com. And it's hard for me to give him a lot of credit for Bryce Harper and Steven Strasburg. I mean, those are no-brainers. And not only were they no-brainers, but those guys are better than most number ones. I mean, everyone talks about how Dansby Swanson being traded from the D-backs to the Braves was such a lopsided trade because they traded 1-1, the first pick in the first round. But Dansby Swanson is nothing in as far as a ceiling in comparison to Bryce Harper and Strasburg. So not only did he get great number ones, but he got generational number ones. You just don't see those guys very often. So it's hard to give him credit for that. But then you look at some of the other guys on that roster, Rendon, and how Ian Desmond developed in the minor leagues finally, which I didn't think he would become the player that he eventually did become, at least for a few of those years. So he deserves credit, and at the same time, it really is. He's kind of a tough case for me to analyze. That's why I wanted to ask you about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. The franchise definitely did get, I guess, lucky, you could say, in the sense that they got the number one pick 2 years when there was a clear number one pick, a huge talent like Harper and Strasburg. I think you have to give them some credit for taking a guy like Anthony Rendon, who other teams passed on because of injury concerns. The Nationals were willing to jump on him. Same thing with drafting a guy like Lucas Giolito, who I'm sure we'll talk about more later, who is coming off Tommy John surgery. You know, the Nationals were the team that was willing to take a chance on a guy like that who had big talent. I think you also have to consider, you know, some of the trades that Rizzo's pulled off. He's had, I think, a pretty good record when it comes to that. Something like the Doug Fister trade with Detroit a couple years ago, which I know Fister didn't have a good year last year, but in 2014, he was a huge part of a pitching staff that helped them win the division. So there's definitely been ups and downs, which I think you could probably say about any GM out there. But I do think that, you know, overall they're, he's had, I would say, a positive impact overall, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I actually think he deserves credit for signing Max Scherzer as well. Not only did he get, I mean, he does a lot of deals with Scott Boras. It almost seems like they maybe they share rooms or something. They talk so often and make so many deals. But the fact is he lured the premier free agent of that class, or at least one of the top few. And it's one thing to lure them there. It's another thing that you pick the right one. If you're going to pay huge money, they have to perform, and so far Scherzer has. I think people deserve that. I mean, I don't think they should be blamed. Say, oh, well, they signed Max Scherzer. That was a no-brainer. Well, Albert Pujols doesn't look like a great deal for the Angels, and Josh Hamilton didn't look good, and the Red Sox with Hanley Ramirez and Pablo. A lot of times you spend decent or even expensive money, and those things don't work out, and his have done well. So he deserves credit for that, in my opinion, even though he probably doesn't. I don't think there are too many people out there praising him for signing Max Scherzer, but that's money well spent in rather than an albatross. And who knows, a couple years down the road, that could change. But
right.
Let me ask you real quickly. I don't want to get into the weeds of it too much, but we heard a little bit of a kind of a griping on the offseason about this TV deal that they have with the Orioles and how it's impacting the way the Nationals are able to do business, or at least affects the stability of how they can negotiate and things like that. And we've seen a lot of free agents kind of use the Nationals as a lobbying way in order to go somewhere else. Is that TV deal just something that they threw out there and it's kind of a controversy in that region? Or does the TV deal where they share with the Orioles or get rights fees or whatever, again, I don't want to get into the specifics of it, but is that TV deal really having any real impact on their organization, do you think, from a free agent perspective or any other?
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, like you mentioned, I mean, they were able to spend $200 million on Scherzer last offseason, although there was a lot of deferred money in the deal, so that takes the actual value down a little bit. But nonetheless, I mean, they spent huge money there. They've certainly spent money at other times on Jason Worth. They had to kind of, you know, overpay the market, I guess you could say, to get Worth to come to a team that really hadn't won at that point. And they made a pretty good run at Jason Hayward this offseason, as well as a few other guys, even though they ultimately didn't sign them. So it's not like the Nationals don't have money. They are in a bit of a tough spot, just in the sense that, you know, they're the only team out there that has their TV rights controlled by another team. And you put that in the context of all the teams that are signing huge, huge rights deals with regional cable networks in the last handful of years, and that does kind of put them at a disadvantage compared to some others.
Yeah, and it looks like I was talking with I think it was either Rob Nyer or maybe Jay Jaffe about a month or so ago, and it almost seems like that could have a 2 or 3 or even 5 year impact based purely on what team signs a new TV deal at what time. So, like, the Phillies sign a gigantic deal, and all of a sudden, the next 5 years, they'll probably be in the hunt and be competitive. And then if a team who doesn't have a deal, maybe they aren't because they don't have a deal. It almost seems like that windfall can skyrocket some teams ahead into competitiveness purely because of the money. And maybe that could result in something with the Nationals. It will be an interesting story to follow moving forward. I just wanted to touch on it real quickly with you because, obviously, you're in the area. And it's easy to throw it out there as a comment in this legal battle, and it's another thing to be able to really tell if it has any real impact, and we probably won't know that until we see all these TV deals. I mean, we've seen the Dodgers just go crazy. We haven't seen the Phillies go nuts yet. I don't think we saw the Diamondbacks go crazy now. So we're starting to see where these TV deals are impacting behavior. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Nationals going forward as well. That's something to keep an eye on, but we're not going to get into the weeds of that today. Let's look at 2015. I like to review teams a little bit, what we expected going into last year, then look into last year before we actually preview what's coming up here in 2016. And what was the impact, in your opinion, of Matt Williams? I don't know if he deserves any blame or any credit or whatever it may be, but that team just never seemed in sync from the very beginning. And I don't know, we love to throw out the idea, oh, well, it's the management or it's the coach, but we don't know that, or at least I don't. Maybe you do. That's the question. Was Matt Williams a good or a bad manager? What was his impact there, and why they just didn't seem to get on track?
I mean, it's always tough with managers to know what the actual impact is. I mean, you know, there weren't, you know, a ton of complaints out there about him in 2014 when they cruised to a division title and he won NL Manager of the Year for, you know, what something like that is worth. You know, was he doing anything different in 2015 than he was in 2014? I mean, probably not. They just, you know, the team got hit with more injuries and the bullpen had all kinds of problems, which is one of those things that always makes a manager look bad. There was a lot of criticism about how Matt Williams handled that bullpen, and I do think that a lot of that was fair. At the same time, there were stretches where he really didn't have anybody he could turn to down there who was trustworthy because of some injuries and some guys not performing. So that definitely put him in a tough spot. I think the biggest thing that was concerning was just, I know that, you know, there were some stories in the Washington Post that came out and maybe some other outlets about the fact that he reportedly was, you know, losing the clubhouse and wasn't real popular among the players. And something like that is always, I think, the biggest concern, even though it's difficult to quantify what that's worth exactly.
Yeah, and it doesn't look good when Papelbon attacks Bryce Harper at the end of the year. It seems to punctuate the story, and it probably doesn't tell it. It probably doesn't tell it accurately, but it punctuates it and seems to give everybody that one incident that they can all look to and say, "See, I knew that was it."
Yeah, I don't know if I'm not sure if he necessarily would have survived had that not happened. I think he may have been on the way out anyway, but if he wasn't already on the way out, I have to believe that was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak.
Yeah, being public doesn't help, that's for sure.
No.
And we will get into it a little bit. Let me ask you real quickly then. People talk about how Papelbon had to be let go, that they might even just release him because of the incident. Instead, it looks like they doubled down and traded away Storen to give Papelbon, because he's going to be there, the clear path to the job there. I think Papelbon's one of the more underrated closers in the game. He's been consistently extremely good. You don't love the guy as the way he talks. I didn't mind him in Boston. The Boston people don't mind vocal, even ridiculous comments. So I didn't mind it when he was here. But obviously, it doesn't seem to rub people all that well. And maybe it doesn't in the clubhouse either. Does it surprise you that they move out Storen and they keep Papelbon after such a high-profile incident with, obviously, the franchise player and Harper?
It's maybe a little bit surprising, but, you know, when you think about it, you know, they are in a bit of a difficult position with that because, you know, a Papelbon's not an easy guy to move right now. I think he's going to make $11 million this year. He's getting up there in age. Obviously, you had the incident that went down with Harper combined with the reputation he already had. And, you know, it was going to be difficult for them to really get anything of significance for him or even get significant salary relief. And Mike Rizzo he said really all along that with both Storen and Papelbon, they were only going to trade those guys if it made baseball sense to do so. And, you know, with Storen, I mean, they were able to get a trade that did make some sense from a baseball perspective in getting Ben Revere. And, you know, I'm sure that with Papelbon, they just haven't – I'm sure they would be open to something, but they haven't found it. And the other problem is you look at their bullpen right now, if they trade Papelbon and they don't add another big-time relief pitcher, who's the closer for that team? Who is pitching in the late innings? Even though they've made a few pretty decent additions to the bullpen this offseason, they don't have another, you know, obvious guy for that role. So I'm sure that's something else that is weighing into it.
Yeah, one of my notes that I plan to get into when we look at 2016 is in this era where everyone wants to have not just a good bullpen, but a loaded one, the Nationals look like they're a little thin. Papelbon's a solid guy, and some of their other arms aren't too bad either, but in comparison to what the Yankees have done and what a few of these other organizations have done, they're actually a little thin in the bullpen. That is something we'll get into a little bit as well. We're talking about the Washington Nationals here with Andrew Simon from MLB.com. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at Andrew Simon MLB. We're talking about the Nationals, and we're reviewing the 2015 season before talking about the offseason and then previewing their 2016 expectations here. And looking back at 2015, at this time last year, what kind of expectations should we have had? Were they fair? You can't be disappointing unless you had high expectations, but were they too high? Did they look like the presumptive number one? Some people were throwing out that they were going to win 100 games, which that's extremely difficult to do, but they were a very talented team coming into the season. But were our expectations too high? Was there something we were missing that we had our expectations so high, or were they truly just that disappointing?
I think for the most part, the expectations were fair. I mean, we're talking about a team that, you know, won the division the year before, won well over 90 games, basically brought pretty much the same team back and added Max Scherzer. So I think it's totally understandable why most people, myself included, you know, expected them to win 90-plus games and win the division again. I think, you know, if there was anything that people were kind of missing about the team, and this isn't really – this is something that's not just specific to the Nationals, but I think to how we kind of look at these things in general, you know, people project and make the predictions based on, you know, what is the top five starting pitchers look like? What is the projected starting lineup look like? And don't think as much about, you know, what about injuries? And if people do get hurt, what does the depth look like to fill in behind them? And, you know, in the end, the team in large part was undone by guys getting hurt. And so, I mean, should people have foreseen that possibility more? Maybe. But I think that's kind of a blind spot that we have in general.
Yeah, and really we probably should. Jason Worth has had injury concerns for quite some time, or off and on for quite some time. Anthony Rendon had – one of the reasons why he fell to the Nationals was because people were afraid he couldn't stay healthy. While at Rice, he couldn't. He had leg and ankle issues in college. So that was a little bit of a concern. One of the reasons why the Nationals got Lucas Giolito was injury concerns. Not here or there. It's just, you know, sometimes the draft that happens where injuries or potential injuries are a reason why a guy falls. And Anthony Rendon is an example of that. And Ryan Zimmerman, I mean, when has he been able to stay healthy? We should have seen it with them. If there's any team that's filled with potential injuries, and Steven Strasburg never throws 200 innings a season, so we probably should have been at least a little bit cognizant of the fact that maybe we shouldn't expect 150 games from all these really good players, and maybe our expectations should have been a little bit lowered, especially if you're predicting 100 wins. I think another thing that we always overlook is that teams that aren't maybe they look like they're a year away, it seems like that's the year that they actually end up having their good season. The Royals are a little bit of an exception. I thought they were too far away for that James Shields trade. I thought that trade wasn't really a good fit for them because I didn't think they'd win in time for James Shields to help them. It turns out the Royals won a year early, even though they didn't win the World Series. They were able to go to the World Series with James Shields on their staff, and I think the Mets fit that description last year. They probably shouldn't have gone to the World Series last year based on what we thought in the preseason, and yet they outperformed expectations. I think that's what teams normally do. Now that the Mets have expectations, I expect them to actually regress and be a little bit of a disappointment this season, whereas the Nationals' expectations are obviously a little bit different. Maybe they end up having a better season. And what I wanted to look at now is the offseason. They signed Daniel Murphy. They trade away Drew Storen in order to get Ben Revere. They let Jordan Zimmerman go, or he just ran. He signed really early. And then Ian Desmond is still floating out there. Let me first ask you about Desmond before we get into the other ones. Is he definitely gone? I mean, it seems like nobody wants him. He had a down year last year, though. I've been writing that I think he's kind of a free agent steal. Now he's going to cost compensation, and that hurts his value for sure. But it seems like he's out there at a very cheap price. Unless you think last year was a sign, and I was looking at the numbers, and while the home runs and the stolen bases have actually been good or better over the recent years, if you look at batting average and OBP and OPS and slugging, he's actually been in a four-year decline. And that was one of my criticisms of the Boston Red Sox when they signed Pablo Sandoval was everyone thought he was a great sign. Everyone thought he was a great player. He was declining in three straight years before he came to Fenway. It was a horrible signing. I was screaming that before it ever happened. Is Ian Desmond, was last year a surprise? Or is he truly in decline? And is there any chance that the Nats sign him at a really friendly deal?
I really don't see him coming back to the Nationals. I guess anything is possible, but, you know, really even before he had officially left, the Nats had kind of moved on in the sense that last offseason they pulled off the trade where they got Trey Turner from the Padres, their shortstop prospect, who's made it up to the big leagues a little bit last year. Then they go out and sign Daniel Murphy, which frees up Danny Espinosa to play some shortstop. They go out and get Steven Drew. I think the Nationals have kind of moved on. So I would be surprised to see the two sides get back together.
Yeah, a big benefit. Do you think he's in decline, or do you think he just had a bad season? Like I said, the bulk stats that fantasy people follow seem to be right there, the home runs and the stolen bases. But you look at the numbers that the sabermetrics people analyze, the slugging and the OPS, and he's been declining for 4 years straight. What's your evaluation on what kind of player he is right now?
He has been in a little bit of a decline since I guess it was 2012 when he had probably his best season. But it, you know, from 12 to 14, it was really more of a gradual thing, and then things kind of fell apart last year. I suppose that could be a sign that he is really in a bad decline that he might not get out of. I would expect him to bounce back at least closer to what he did in 2014 last year. And even in 13 and 14, when he didn't hit quite as well as he did in 2012, he was still a very valuable player when you consider defense and base running and the position that he's playing. He was still, a guy who was 3 or 4 wins above replacement, which is pretty valuable. So, for any team that's looking into Desmond now, it would definitely be a risk. But considering how long he stayed on the market, and I imagine how much the prices drop with him, I think it would be, a risk worth taking for somebody.
And that's what I've been saying. Is it? I'm not sure. To be honest, I don't know. Because again, 4 years of decline in those stats, but yet the counting stats are still good. It makes me wonder. But at the same time, it just seems like he has to be such a good deal. But it really depends on what you think of him. If he's in decline or outright done, I mean, maybe he's on his way to hitting bottom. And 2015 was maybe the last season he's even respectable, because he did finish strong. He started really poorly. But if you don't think he can play shortstop, and you're wondering if maybe he can transition to the outfield, which is an assumption based on his athleticism, there's no evidence to confirm or I guess refute the fact that he can do that. But that's a risk to sign a guy who's never played the position you intend to put him at. That's certainly risky. And then if you don't think he's going to hit, or you don't think he's going to get on base, he's definitely risky, but the price really does seem right. So
Yeah.
he is interesting.
And you just touched on it there, but if you look at his numbers after the All-Star break, his average on base and slugging, it basically looked like what he'd done the previous couple years. And as far as defensively, he had a really rough April. I think he made like 8 or 10 errors, something like that, and then he kind of settled down. So if you look at him from about mid-season on, he basically looked like the same player he had been. So, if you wanted to take an optimistic view of things, you could definitely say that, maybe early in the year he was, pressing because it was a contract year, something like that, and he eventually kind of found his level. You can't just, throw the first half of the season out the window, but it's definitely something to consider.
Yeah, and that's what makes them so complicated. There are pros and cons on every side on everything. You can really make an argument for everything when it comes to him. That's what makes him so intriguing and why his price seems so interesting. The trade for Ben Revere. You get rid of Storen, and like I said, your bullpen's not bad, or the Nationals' bullpen, not yours, unless you've got an interesting team in your backyard. But they could have used another one, unless Storen and Pabon just can't survive together or whatever it may be. I didn't see the real need to trade away Storen. And I guess the question is, I like Ben Revere. I don't think he's that big of a difference of Denard Span, who was a guy that the Nationals had before. Those kinds of outfields, I always talk about that with the Boston Red Sox. Jackie Bradley Jr. has had his issues with offense, but if you can play defense and run a little bit, you've got value as a center fielder. So Ben Revere is nice for when it comes to that. But you had Michael Taylor out there, and he's a very different type of player, I think, than a Ben Revere. Was trading away Storen when the bullpen could have used him a sign that maybe they don't trust Taylor, or did they just really like Revere? I'm not exactly sure. This seems like a sideways move rather than a need move. Again, unless you have concerns about Michael Taylor the player or whether Michael Taylor can play center field consistently. I'm curious what your read was on why the Nationals made that trade.
Yeah, I think there's a few things that come to mind there. One is, I mean, in a vacuum, they definitely could use Storen. I just think it was one of those things where it was probably best for both sides for him to move on. You know, this is a guy who essentially three different times in the last 3 or 4 years, they've replaced him as a closer. You know, they did it last year when they traded for Papelbon, even though at the time Storen was having a great season. They did it a few years ago when they signed Rafael Soriano. And I think it's just at a certain point, I mean, you couldn't help, you know, you couldn't blame Storen for if he felt like the organization had sort of lost some confidence in him at that point. So I think it was just something where it was maybe better for him to go get a clean slate somewhere else. And from the Nationals' perspective, you know, I think there's a lot to like about Michael Taylor. He's a great defender in center field. He's got quite a bit of power. He runs well. But, you know, he had, I think, an on-base percentage well below 300 last year. Swings and misses a lot. He's not really a guy that you want hitting at the top of your lineup. And I don't think even, you know, in his prime, he'll be a number one or number two type hitter. You go out and get Ben Revere. He doesn't have real high on-base percentages either, but he's a guy who does make a lot of contact. And I think that that's something that the Nationals wanted more of in their lineup. You look at the two of their major acquisitions, Ben Revere and Daniel Murphy. Both guys are left-handed hitters, which is something that they wanted more of. And you look at last year, those two guys had two of the lowest rates of swings and misses last year, two of the highest contact rate. The Nationals are a team that swung and missed a lot last year, and I think they wanted to kind of change the dynamic a little bit.
Yeah, Michael Taylor is interesting, and again, I do a fantasy sports baseball podcast as well, and Michael Taylor really kind of hits all of the erogenous zones when it comes to fantasy players. He's got an immense amount of athleticism. He hit 14 home runs and stole 16 bases. Those are fantasy stats we love to see. But then as you move down into the baseball side of things, he batted 229, which is a concern, but people can live with 229. I mean, Chris Davis, as long as he hits 40-plus homers, he can hit whatever the heck he wants. But 282 on-base percentage is something that teams look at and say, that's just unacceptable. And unless you're a four-win defender, and maybe Michael Taylor is a good defender, but is he the best defender in all of baseball? You kind of have to be to overcome a 282 on base percentage. That is, now again, he was a rookie, a young player. He played 138 games, so you'd expect that to get better. But if that's your read as an organization, you can't have a guy not only at the top of the lineup, but really even in the lineup at all, batting 280, an on base percentage of 282. You put him next to the pitcher, and sometimes you might say, you know what, I'd rather pitch to Taylor than pitch to the pitcher. I mean, 282 is just not a number that you can live with. But I would have thought he'd get better, but that you can understand why that would be a concern.
Yeah, and look, I mean, we were just talking before, you know, referring to last season about injuries and depth. I mean, Michael Taylor, you know, as of right now is the fourth outfielder, but, you know, how many games is Jason Worth going to play this year? You know, if Worth misses time, you know, as of now, Taylor would be back in the lineup, and they would probably shift Ben Revere over to left field, I would imagine. You know, Bryce Harper's had injuries before. You know, you can't forget about that. So it's not like Michael Taylor is just being, you know, tossed aside. I think he's still going to play quite a bit this year.
Yeah. The one thing that I think probably hurts him a little bit is that Ben Revere's got two more years left on his deal, and Michael Taylor getting part-time at bat, if he's ever going to become the player, either a full-time player or potentially a star, because the athleticism is there to be a star, whether he can be that or not, whether he can make enough contact, that's really the issue. But to not allow him to get the at-bats to possibly develop into that, I mean, maybe he's too far along now. I mean, prospects, you can only develop for so long before you have to either produce or accept the fact that you're a utility guy or a fourth outfielder. It's not ideal, probably, to try to figure that out. It would have been nice to see him get a full-time opportunity, and it looks like, obviously, he's not going to get that. Unless, of course, Jason Worth gets injured again or something like that. Then, or they bring the DH back before the season starts, which it doesn't look like that's going to happen either. So,
yeah.
You'd like to see him get 400 at-bats, but it doesn't look like he's going to get it.
Yeah. I mean, it also depends what kind of team you are. I mean, if Michael Taylor were on a rebuilding team, you'd say, for sure, stick him out there for, the whole season, get as many at-bats as he can and see if he can develop. The Nationals are the team that's trying to win right now, maybe don't have the same luxury to do that.
Yeah, I would agree. That's what makes it even more difficult is maybe Michael Taylor's a guy that they should look to trade. He would be a great fit on a team, like you said, that's rebuilding. I agree. Maybe like a Phillies. It seems like everybody wants to trade with the Phillies or something like that. But, it's probably not a great sign. Moving on to the Daniel Murphy signing. I wasn't a big fan of him. When you look at the offseason, you try to predict where people are going. You try to look and see who has the needs and what player has the skills and the tools to fit those needs. And I just have a hard time finding a tool that I really, really like about Daniel Murphy, and therefore I had a very difficult time placing him on any one organization. He can do a lot of things, but he doesn't do a lot of them all that great. He did hit 14 home runs in only 130 games. He doesn't run. But he batted .281 with an on-base of .322, hardly terrible, not by no means. .322 is a very good on-base percentage at the very least. What did you think of the signing there? Did it make sense? Was it a surprise? And is he a good fit there? And he can play a lot of different spots, as Rendon can as well. What is his role going to be? Could he play second and third and the occasional first? I guess from that perspective, I kind of do like him, because maybe even though he doesn't play anything all that great, he can be serviceable, I guess you'd say, at a lot of different places.
Yeah. I would expect him to be, the regular second baseman. As things stand now, I don't really see him getting a lot of time at other spots. The Nationals want Anthony Rendon to play third base every day. They have Ryan Zimmerman at first. Clint Robinson, who had a real nice year for them last year as a left-handed hitter off the bench, could take some starts at first base also. Obviously, with injuries that could happen, you never know where things might go. And it is nice that, if they had to put him at third or first, that would be an option. But I think, the plan is to have him, mostly play second base. Like I mentioned before, I think part of the appeal with him was definitely the fact that he had one of the, lowest strikeout rates in the league last year. They also wanted another left-handed bat in the lineup because really outside of Bryce Harper, they were very right-handed. So that's something that they were looking at. The defense is probably the biggest concern with him. He's never been a guy that's rated particularly well defensively, and that's not likely to get any better as he gets older. So that was something that was maybe a little bit of a trade-off. You hope that if Ryan Zimmerman's healthy, he has enough range to maybe cover up a little bit of Murphy's deficiency there.
Yeah, and one thing that I think a lot of us get caught up in, and I'm guilty of it from time to time as well, is that you look at the money and therefore you think a player is a bad sign or a bad fit because of the money. We shouldn't care about the money. The one thing that I continue saying, I wrote about this as well over at minorleagueball.com, is that we shouldn't care about the money unless it stops you from doing other things. And 3 years, $37.5 million should not be preventing the Nationals from doing anything they want to. So from my perspective, you shouldn't care what you gave them. just look at Daniel Murphy, the player. And like you said, the defense is probably the biggest concern. Because while he's probably going to be the full-time second baseman, he's not a very good defender. Maybe Rendon at second is better and Murphy over third. I don't know. Maybe that's something that could develop. Who knows? Probably not, like you said.
But yeah. No, they were pretty clear that they want Rendon to play third base, which I think is the right call. I mean, he can definitely handle second, but he's a really good third baseman when he's healthy. So I think that's, you know, in everyone's best interest.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you as well. And keeping him healthy is definitely the most important thing. But as an offensive player, again, he doesn't hit a ton of home runs, but he hits a few. The batting average and the on base is good. So just when you ignore the money or when you ignore the fact that he was one of the more touted free agents of this class, you just look at it from that perspective. He's a good player. So the Nationals, and they only paid him for 3 years and only a little over $12.5 million per season. So that's actually, I think, a good signing. It just, I guess you, when people are talking about 5 years and $70 million or something, it's like, whoa, that creates an environment that's probably unfair to Daniel Murphy. I actually do think he's a nice player. And like I said, if they had to, if there were injuries or problems, he probably could try a little third. He could probably play a little bit of first. You don't want him doing those things, but he probably can. And that, you know, even though he doesn't play any of those places well, which is kind of funny, he's a utility player that does them all poorly. He's still a nice player. I think he's a better signing than I was originally giving him credit for. But let me ask you about the guys they lost. Jordan Zimmermann and Denard Span. You get Revere, and as I said before, I don't see a significant difference between those two, but maybe you do. I'm curious about what you think. And did they ever have a chance at keeping Zimmermann? Do you think there's a – and what do you think the impact is of the fact that he left?
I'm sure that they perhaps could have made a run at Zimmermann, but it just – I mean, really, even from before we even got to the offseason, it seemed clear that Zimmermann, along with Desmond and probably Stan and definitely Doug Fister, were all going to leave. They're just – you know, in Zimmerman's case, there just had never really been any progress made – as far as talking about any kind of extension. And it just seems clear that he was a guy who wanted to test the free agent market, which you can definitely understand. I think, you know, he's you know, a Wisconsin guy. I'm not sure how much him wanting to go back to the Midwest somewhere might have played into it. I'm sure, you know, the money usually, you know, plays the biggest role in these things, but that certainly could have been a factor. It just seemed like there was never really any momentum towards the Nationals keeping him, especially after they dropped the big money on Scherzer the year before.
Yeah, and I liked him. I think he's a nice player, but I don't think it's a killer. Do you think there's a significant loss there with Denard Span leaving? Would you be better off of paying Denard Span, keeping Drew Storen and Ben Revere still being in Toronto, or do you think they're better off with Storen gone, Revere in-house, and Span not signing as a free agent?
I mean, I probably would rather have Span and Storen, but, you know, again, there were other issues with Storen aside from, you know, just on-field type stuff. And, you know, Span's definitely, you know, a risk. You don't really know how, you know, he had a few different surgeries last year, and it's just difficult to say how that might affect him going forward. I think he probably has a higher ceiling than Revere, you know, if he's able to stay healthy. But Revere is probably the more dependable guy in terms of counting on him to play 140 games this year and stay on the field. So he probably has a higher floor. So, you know, you can make an argument either way, but it does maybe give them a little bit more stability.
And let's look ahead to 2016 here. And where are the position battles on this team? It seems like there's not a lot, but at the same time, there does look like there are a few.
Yeah. There's not a whole lot. I mean, I guess that right now there's, you know, some question about what's going to happen with shortstop. You have Murphy at second base. Then you have Danny Espinosa. you have Stephen Drew, and you have Trey Turner, who MLB.com just put out the 2016 Top 100 Prospects list. He was number 11 overall on that. He made his debut last year, a very talented player, played really well in the minor leagues last year. I wouldn't be surprised at all, though, if they started him in AAA, where he didn't get a whole lot of time last year, and started the year with Danny Espinosa playing shortstop and maybe getting spelled a little bit by Stephen Drew. But I suppose possible that Turner could, you know, make a case for himself in spring training. Go ahead.
I was just going to – no, finish your point. I was going to move on to the next one.
That was pretty much the story with shortstop. Then you do have a little bit of a question maybe with the starting rotation. The Nats did bring in Bronson Arroyo on a minor league deal. Veteran guy coming back from injury, didn't pitch at all last season. You wonder if it's possible that he might make the rotation. It's definitely possible if someone were to get hurt. If not, you wonder if maybe he might make the team over someone like Joe Ross, if they would start Ross in the minor leagues potentially. We'll have to, I guess, wait and see how Arroyo looks in spring training and how he is bouncing back.
And you mentioned before how the Nationals are going for it, and really they're always going for it. their team is too good not to. But it does seem like that had a significant impact on what they did this offseason. You look at Wilmer Difo, who I think is a pretty nice player, an intriguing prospect. Trey Turner, like you said, a lot of people love him. And not only is he a very good prospect, but he could potentially, a lot of people think he might be a star. So he's your future shortstop. If Difo can develop and continue to move forward and some of those skills and athleticism can come out, he could be your starting second baseman. Then you got Michael Taylor, the young guy in the outfield. And then, like you said, Joe Ross. These are a lot of young guys that on a developing team, maybe they start the season in the minors and then come up, or maybe they do start on opening day, like kind of like the Twins last season, who kind of went for it with some young players, or like the Astros, who promoted everybody very quickly. It seems like the Nationals, if they weren't expected to win or in a better position, if they weren't in the position they are, which is a good one, maybe these guys are a key to this team in 2016. But because they are expected to win, they go out there and they shore up things, and they add Murphy, and they add Drew, who is – I don't know how he gets the money he gets, but he finds a way to get it. Scott Boras is a genius. But then they go out and trade for Ben Revere. I mean, that makes sense when you're trying to win in 2016. So it really does look like the Nationals are kind of stuck, which is a good thing because they want to win. But they probably didn't need to sign Murphy. They probably didn't need to trade for Revere. And they probably didn't need to sign Drew if they were a team that was a 2017 or a 2018 type team. But they're not. They were supposed to win in 2014 and 15. So they had to go out. And because of that, it looks like their offseason was kind of built based on that. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning of the offseason, you looked at their roster, and the one thing that really stuck out that they needed to address was the bullpen, which they ended up doing. As far as the rotation and the lineup, I mean, there wasn't, any spot that was a glaring weakness. They maybe had several spots where they could have made some sort of upgrade, but there weren't really like obvious holes. Center field was something that they could look to upgrade, maybe, second base or short, but they did have a lot of flexibility in what they can do. And I think maybe in trying to prevent some of the issues that came up last year, kind of look to add to their depth and fill things in a little bit.
Yeah, and looking at this, let's look at the rotation a little bit. We're talking with Andrew Simon from MLB.com, and he also writes, you can find some of his work over at sportsonearth.com. If you'd like to follow him on Twitter, it's at Andrew Simon MLB. We're talking about the Washington Nationals. We're previewing the 2016 season here on a podcast to be named later. And let me ask you about that rotation, because It looks like the Nationals are trying to move on from Gio Gonzalez, and it doesn't look like there are a lot of takers. And when you look at him, it looks like he's in decline. And that's always what I'm looking at is when you're trying to figure out whether a team was disappointing or overachieved, and we're trying to look and see where they find these games. The Nationals won 83, so they probably have to find a way to get to at least 89 or 90, 91 wins. Where do you find that? Where do you find those wins, or where do you find those losses if they are going to decline, which I don't think the Nationals are going to, but that's the other side of the coin. And Gio Gonzalez seems like a guy who maybe that's a place where you need to get better rather than worse. So he did have a 3.79 ERA, but it was a 1.42 whip. He threw 175 innings. Is this a guy that's declining and is a concern, or is this a guy who had maybe a mediocre, or is he better than maybe I'm kind of giving credit for? I'm curious what you think. Strasburg and Scherzer at the top is fantastic. If Gio Gonzalez was that 200 strikeout guy, you know, the Nationals really look formidable. But what do you expect from Gio this year?
Yeah, I mean, he's a little bit of a tough guy to pin for me because, you know, you watch him pitch and he can be, you know, a very frustrating guy to watch, you know, because he'll go out there and, you know, he can't get the ball over the plate. He'll walk the bases loaded and then maybe he'll wiggle out of it, or he's cruising along and then all of a sudden he hits a rough patch and he can't get out of it. You know, he's walked, you know, I think over three batters per nine innings every season. He is able to get a decent amount of strikeouts, you know, because he throws a lot of pitches, gets his pitch counts up. He's not a guy who is going to probably throw a ton of innings. You know, as a number three or number four starter, I think, you know, you definitely could do a lot worse. And I think there's still some upside there, but, you know, it seems pretty unlikely at this point that he's going to get back to the kind of pitcher he was his first season in Washington in 2012, when I think he, you know, won over 20 games, had an ERA under three, I think finished third in Cy Young voting that year. It just seems like he's slipped a little bit off of that level. But, you know, for the middle of the rotation, I mean, I'm not sure that the Nationals are, at least for this year, are going to be able to upgrade over that.
Yeah, and that was always a concern. A little bit as a prospect early on when he was with the White Sox before being traded over to the Nationals. Command was always an issue for him. Filthy curveball, pretty decent velocity, not a 99-mile-an-hour guy, but very few lefties are. But he was always a strikeout guy with that curveball, but command was always an issue. So it's not a stunner that, for the most part, his major league career has been that way. It's just you combine the strikeouts and the dominance with a little bit of the command issues, and you get a good pitcher rather than, you know, a Hall of Famer. I mean, that's the way it works. That's not a bad thing. Looking at the bottom of the rotation, you mentioned Ross may be starting in AAA. Would he be – again, you got Tanner Roark, who is an intriguing guy. Who's going to be the bottom two spots there? And would Ross being conveniently demotable, is that going to hurt him? Is he going to have to really clear the field in order to stay in? Because Ross has a lot of potential. He was a steal, it seems like, in that trade last year. The Nationals did a really great job there. But it looks like Ross is a guy that you would probably like better than Arroyo and Roark, but maybe he gets demoted. I'm curious. Who do you think of the last two starters there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're talking about these kinds of situations, you know, it's not just, you know, who's the better pitcher. You know, these roster considerations, you know, always factor in who has options left, you know, who, you know, a guy like Bronson Arroyo, you know, if they want to keep him around, you know, he may not go to AAA. You know, they may have to, you know, put him in the rotation if they want to keep him. I think right now, you know, the onus is still on Arroyo to come into spring training, prove that he's healthy, and prove that, you know, he still has what it takes to get major league hitters out. I mean, this is a guy who had Tommy John surgery, missed all of last season, you know, never had, you know, he never was a guy with, like, big-time stuff anyways. But it still remains to be seen how he'll do. So You know, the Nats haven't, they only signed him to a minor league deal. They didn't guarantee him anything. I think he'll make at least $2 million if he makes the rotation, and then there's some incentives on top of that. So I think first of all that, you know, we have to see what Arroyo is capable of. And then if, you know, he looks good enough, then it'll become an interesting question of what happens with those last couple spots. Tanner Roark had a great year kind of out of nowhere in 2014. And then last year with Scherzer coming in, he, you know, was the guy that got sent to the bullpen, even though, you know, he didn't really deserve that kind of fate, and ended up kind of bouncing back and forth a little bit between the rotation and the bullpen, and it just never gelled for him. So I think it would be awfully tough to put him in that sort of position again. I think he deserves a chance to be in the rotation and, you know, show what he can do there. But at the same time, I think Joe Ross looked really good last year, and I think he clearly has a higher ceiling than either Roark or Arroyo does.
And what about A.J. Cole? I've always thought that he was a prospect that had a good arm, but that he was eventually going to be a bullpen guy. But it seems like maybe he's in the mix, though maybe an outsider looking in. But at least I'm looking at one of the depth charts on rotoworld.com, and they have him as the number six, whether he's 6, 7, 8 or whatever. But nonetheless, they have him as a potential starter. Does Cole have a chance to be a starter? Because, again, I've always envisioned him eventually being a bullpen guy. I like the arm. But it looks like, at least based on RotoWorld, and their depth chart's going to be wrong, does he have a chance to maybe be a starter? And maybe if he does well, maybe get into the mix there?
You know, I think there's a chance. I think it would, you know, it would take multiple injuries for him to, you know, open the season in the rotation. He's still a guy that could be around to possibly come up and step into the rotation at some point. He got up for a couple games last year. He had made his major league debut in Atlanta and had a really, really rough outing. He's still certainly an interesting prospect, but I think there's a lot of questions about, you know, if he really is going to be a starter at the major league level or whether he eventually will be suited to the bullpen. I just heard something recently, Jim Callis, who, you know, very respected prospect writer who works for MLB.com now, he was talking a couple days ago, I think, about the Nationals and saying he views A.J. Cole more as a reliever going forward, and that certainly wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, no, we've had Jim Callis on the show many times. Love the work that he does. Absolutely, take it as gospel. He does a great job. You guys are lucky to have grabbed him and to have him. He does great stuff. Let's look real quickly at a couple of the veterans, and then I'll get your prediction, and we'll let you out of here. Anthony Rendon, health is an issue, as we've talked about a little bit. Are the Nationals going to do anything to try to help him? Is he going to play? Maybe get more days off? Is there any way that they're going to handle Rendon that maybe we should be looking at to expect, again, maybe 130 games rather than 150, or are they just going to throw him out there and hope for the best?
I'm not really sure, to be honest, what their specific plans are. You know, you always like to say, well, you know, we're gonna get this guy some rest, but then you get into the season, you're trying to win games, and you know, that's sometimes easier said than done. So I'm not really sure what's going to happen with that. I imagine they're going to want him out there, you know, as much as they possibly can. And remember, I mean, in 2014, this is a guy who played 153 games, you know, was out there every day and, you know, really had a great season, was one of the better players in the league. So the injuries are a concern, but I think it's not out of the realm of possibility that he could get right back to that 2014 level, especially considering, you know, he's still only 25 years old.
Yeah. And Bryce Harper, I don't think we can do an entire show about the Nationals without at least talking about him. Even though there's not a lot of brilliant insight or clever things we can really say, the guy's a monster. But I guess the question is, did we just see the tip of the iceberg? Is there better to come? Can you be much better than he was last year? In general, I mean, people talk about how he plays too hard. It's a weird way to say it. It's weird to criticize a guy because he plays too hard, but you hear that from time to time, and you hear about that as a concern with him. But really, can he do better than he was last year? Are we going to actually see better? It's amazing how good of a season he had, and I guess that's the question. He kind of carried them last year. Is he going to carry them again?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he just turned 23 years old in October, so it feels sort of ridiculous to say that, you know, he peaked last year and that's as good as he's ever going to be. But it's also hard to sit here and look at what he did last year and then expect him to be better than that. We're talking about a guy who, you know, led the majors in wins above replacement, had probably the best offensive season we've seen since Barry Bonds was around. You look at any projection system and they're not going to expect him to get up to that level again. You still do have to worry a little bit about the injuries, although last year he proved that he can get through a season. And we did see him last year, I think, consciously make more of an effort to rein himself in. You didn't see him go slamming into any outfield walls, being, you know, too reckless on the bases. I think he came around to realizing how important he is to this team and that above all, he needs to keep himself on the field. And that's more important than maybe making a catch or getting an extra base on one particular play. So I think, you know, as long as he stays healthy, I would absolutely expect him to, you know, be one of the better players in the league, be an MVP candidate again. But I'm not going to sit here and say he's going to match what he did last year because, that was just an absolutely breathtaking season.
Yeah, I try to project conservatively because more often than not, people don't reach those highest of expectations. So I would agree that we should be cautious on projecting what he'll do going forward. But it is amazing, and it wouldn't shock me at all if he does it again. But like you said, to predict that for anyone ever is really kind of being ridiculous. So that's just the kind of season he had. I agree with 100%. It just doesn't make sense to predict it, but it wouldn't surprise anybody if he did it again. It really is amazing the season he had in 2015. Last thing about the Nationals before I ask about your predictions. Any prospects that we can look to that could make a contribution and maybe matter? We talked a little. I mentioned Diffo. We talked about Turner. Taylor isn't really a prospect, but he is a young player. Ross as well. Any other prospects or players that maybe are a little bit further out on the horizon that maybe not everybody knows about that could make an appearance and maybe even an impact on the Nats this season?
Well, I think we touched on Lucas Giolito a little bit earlier, and he's, you know, a guy that people are very excited about. MLB.com just ranked him, I believe, the number 3 overall prospect in the game and the number 1 pitcher on the list. The Nats took him out of high school a few years back. He had Tommy John surgery, came back during the 2013 season, and he's just really been impressive. You hear scouts say that he has, you know, one of the best fastballs and best curveballs in the minor leagues. He's, you know, like 6'6", big frame. He basically has everything that scouts look for in a pitcher. So he got up to Double-A last year. I think he'll probably start back there this year, I would imagine, but it's definitely not out of the realm of possibility that he could be up in the major leagues at some point this season. And, assuming that Steven Strasburg leaves after this season, this is his last year before free agency, I think it's definitely reasonable to think that he could be in their rotation next year.
Yeah, if you're going to draw a picture of the modern-day monster on the mound, Giolito's it. He's in fantasy sports, and that's a lot of the ways I look at players a lot of times, they care about offense more than pitching. But to me, pitching in Major League Baseball is more important. So for me, if I had to, Byron Buxton has phenomenal upside. He could be the next Mike Trout, or Carlos Gomez is really who I compare Buxton to, but nonetheless, he could be that superstar. But to me, if you could have one prospect, I love Giolito. I love pitchers. I love watching pitchers dominate. I love seeing pitchers embarrass hitters. Giolito brings it all. He is probably my favorite prospect in baseball. He is. He's a monster. He looks exactly like what he should be as far as a stud pitcher goes, and so I'm on board with him completely. I'd love to see him up there. And the Nats are very – I mean, they may lose Strasburg, but Giolito will be a very nice replacement to slide in right behind Scherzer when that does happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot here. You got to make a prediction. Last year, some people had the Nats winning 100. They ended up winning 83. There's a lot of room for improvement there, and you'd have to think they probably can improve, even though they did lose some players. What do you think of the Nats in 2016 as far as wins and losses, and what do you expect from them?
I think I would be surprised if they didn't bounce back at least somewhat this year. Like we talked about, there are just so many things that went wrong last year. They also, of course, they brought in Dusty Baker to replace Matt Williams as manager. He's kind of a polarizing figure, but, you know, if you want someone to kind of help bring the clubhouse together, he has a good reputation when it comes to that. I think between them and the Mets, I think, you know, they're probably pretty close right now. There's still things that could happen between now and when the season starts. But, I think I would peg the Nationals for somewhere in the 88 to 90 win range at the moment.
And do they win the division, or do the Mets still get it done?
I think you have to give the Mets a slight edge at this point. They are the defending champions. They do have that great rotation, and their offense actually looks pretty good with bringing Cespedes back, having Michael Conforto for a whole season. So I would give the Mets a slight edge right now, but it also wouldn't surprise me in the least if the Nationals took the division back.
Yeah, I'm going to lean on the expectations thing that I talked about before is, when you don't expect a lot, teams usually outperform. And when teams have expectations, like, for example, the Indians or the White Sox last year, they usually underperform those expectations. To me, that's what the Mets are. They are probably a little bit better. Conforto might be the key to it. I mean, they add Cespedes, but could he be any better than he was in August? So adding Cespedes for an entire season is definitely an improvement. But Conforto, if he can play like a very good offensive player, then that's offense they really didn't get for a lot of last season. So I think he's probably a key there. But I'm expecting some regression. So you go from 90 for the Mets down to, say, 87, 86, 88. The Nats, like you said, all their issues, they move up a little. I think it's going to be a very close fight, but I think the Nats are going to take it. We'll see, though. But Baker may be what they need. Maybe Matt Williams wasn't able to handle the clubhouse, and that's why they were disappointing, or maybe it's just the fact that they had all the injuries and all the issues there. But if the Nats play up to their potential, I think they're actually a little bit better than the Mets. So I'm going with a tight fight and going with your Nationals here. Andrew Simon from MLB.com, final question. The show is named A Podcast to Be Named Later. So I'd like to ask all of our guests, when we do name it later, what is the name we should give this podcast? I want your thoughts. Give us a name for a podcast to be named later when, in the distance, I actually give it a new name.
Oh man, you're really putting me on the spot. I'm never very good at coming up with headlines.
I'm not either, which is why I came up with the podcast to be named later, so I can do it later. I can just procrastinate and keep pushing it off.
I mean, this is kind of a cop out, but I mean, to be honest, I like that name. I always like the player to be named later in those trades that come across, and following them over the years. Trey Turner, who we talked about earlier, he was a player to be named later for a while there. So I think that's not all bad.
Yeah, that, he was one of the more intriguing players to be named later, even though he was named earlier. I happen to like the name myself as well, and it it can be a cop-out unless you're sincere in saying it, and you're not the only person. Of all the guests, only one of them have come up with a name, and I do put you on the spot, and I didn't mention it to you off-air beforehand so that you didn't know. I like to catch people off the spot when it comes to this question, so I'm not going to apologize for it, but I do it intentionally, and only one person has come up with an alternative name. So you're on, Rob Nyer didn't come up with another name, Jay Jaffe didn't, our other guests who have done these MLB wraparounds, all of them came up with the same comment, which is, I like the name as it is.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
All right, Andrew Simon from MLB.com. You can also find his work over at spotsonearth.com. If you want to follow him on Twitter, and I highly recommend that you do, it's at Andrew Simon MLB. Andrew, thanks a lot for coming on. Really appreciate it. Hopefully you'll be able to come back later, but thanks for talking some baseball here in January. The Nationals, interesting team. Thanks a lot for bringing the insights today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
All right, everybody, that's Andrew Simon. Again, you can follow him on Twitter at Andrew Simon MLB. You can read his stuff over at MLB.com and sportsonearth.com. Does fantastic work at both of those places. Loved having him on talking Nats today. So that's our show for today. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. If you'd like to follow me online, there are lots of different places to do that. At CJMitch73, if you want to just follow me on Twitter, I can direct you to wherever you need to go or wherever you want to go, whether you want to listen to the podcast, whether you want to read some of my writings. There's lots of different places. If you're a hockey guy, head on to FantasyDraft.com. I write hockey for them. If you want to know about fantasy sports and specifically about minor league prospects, you can go over to rotoexperts.com. I'm actually in the process of writing an article right now. I'm also working on the fantasy, the preview, the draft preview stuff when it comes to minor league prospects. So if you want to read my fantasy analysis about minor league prospects, you can head on over to rotoexperts.com. If you want to read some of my fantasy stuff, I'm actually in the Baseball America fantasy magazine, which I think is either came out or is coming out. And I haven't received it yet, but it's supposed to be coming. So you can read me in that magazine, which you can also get online over at their website, baseballamerica.com. Also, during the fantasy season, I think I'm going to be writing for them. I wrote for them last season. I'm hoping to be writing for them again. I love the work they do over there. So hopefully if you want just general fantasy baseball content, you can head on over to baseballamerica.com for me. Just for general baseball stuff, and if you want to listen to our podcasts, you can do that over at minorleagueball.com. All of our podcasts eventually get posted there. So if you want to go over to minorleagueball.com, I post the podcast there. I also write general blogs and articles. I've got some interesting articles coming up. I'm going to write about Rich Hill. I think he's one of the better off-season signings of this year. I'm going to praise his signing by Billy Bean. I'm also looking at the DH. I'm also looking at the four-man rotation. I think we're going to see less innings. Starting pitchers are going to go shorter into games. They're going to one of the inefficiencies in the game right now, I think, is trying to get through a lineup a third time. A lot of pitchers can obviously get through once. They can get through twice. But once you get to that third time around, a lot of these mediocre or just innings eater type guys, that's when they start to struggle. I think that's why you're seeing the bullpen being such a dominant and such a priority for teams now, is that we're going to see starters going maybe even four innings. I mean, if they struggle, maybe they go three or four. You bring in all these bullpen arms that throw 98 miles an hour for 20 or 30 pitches. It's my opinion, rather than going to the six-man rotation, which seems to be people seem to think that because these guys can't go as deep and can't throw as many innings, that we're maybe going to see six-man rotations. I think it's the opposite. I'm counterintuitive on this one. I think they're going to go to four, and you're going to see guys throwing 60, 70, 75 pitches an outing and then coming back. And we're going to see larger bullpens, more relievers on rosters, and we'll see more of these guys. We're going to see guys throwing maybe a couple innings as a reliever rather than one. And we'll see a lot more of these one-inning type guys. Maybe less of these one-batter type relievers, but I think we're going to see more relievers throwing one inning at a time. So I'm preparing an article, excuse me, and I'm doing the research. the numbers have to agree with me in order for me to be able to make that statement. But this is my opinion. Some of the data that I've seen seems to suggest that this is a possibility, but I'm still doing that. I'm still preparing that. So that's going to come up hopefully in the not-too-distant future. So lots of interesting articles hopefully coming up. You can get those over at minorleagueball.com. But thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Again, I'd like to thank Andrew Simon from MLB.com and SportsOnEarth.com for coming on to the program today. He did a fantastic job. Love talking with him. And the Nationals are an interesting squad, so an interesting bunch of minutes today here on the podcast. If you want to follow us on Facebook, you can do that as well. I have two podcasts, one fantasy-related and one not. It's the Roto Experts Fantasy Sports Show on Facebook. And, of course, if you want to follow this podcast on Facebook and talk baseball with us, it's a podcast to be named later. Head on over to the Facebook page, sign up, ask for permission to join the group. I'll accept you in, and we can start talking baseball together. Again, a podcast to be named later. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy your Super Bowl this weekend. Enjoy all of your upcoming baseball talk, and hopefully you'll be back. Coming up next, we're going to be talking with Vincent Lara from Baseball.com. We're going to talk some prospects, and actually we're going to talk with him next week about the Florida Marlins. We're going to continue our wraparound in the National League East. Thanks, everybody. Be good, be safe, and enjoy everything going on right now with baseball. Great time to be talking baseball. Fantastic weather for February. So everybody enjoy. Thanks.